call the meeting of the February 18th, 2026 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. Before we begin our meeting, I want to remind everyone that signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause and other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, sitting or standing in the sidewalks and aisles or standing or obstructing at your seat is prohibited. If you require accommodation, please speak to our sergeant staff identified by the gold ties. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entering if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Thank you to the Sergeant at Arms staff who were present to help maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Bliss, have you had a chance to review the minutes of the April 9th, 2025 meeting?
I have, and I move them forward, please.
Representative Bliss moves to approve the April 9th, 2025 minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion carries and minutes of the April 9th, 2025 meeting are approved. This being the first meeting of the Public Safety Committee after a long and disturbing summer and spring, I just want to make out the point that we have very limited hearing space and time, and last year we were able to get bipartisan bills done that affected everyone and pushed through in a good spirit. How the rest of these the short session goes will depend a lot on the members here, and I just hope that we can work through and get good things done and protect the people of Minnesota as they should have the right to expect us to do. We're going to start out with a couple remarks from different people, starting off with and in honor of three public safety officers that were killed on this date. Representative Witte, the vice chair, would like to comment on that incident. And Representative Berg, if you wanted to get in on that also. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. 2 years ago, three first responders, two police officers and a paramedic firefighter lost their lives in Burnsville serving their community. And I just asked that their ultimate sacrifice not be forgotten, and if we could have just a moment of silence.
Thank you. Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say thank you. This was a tragic day, one that impacted our community as a whole. And they died doing what they loved and serving their higher calling. And that is always something to be honored. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Moeller, as I said, you were much closer to Speaker Emeritus Hortman, and I'd like to give you some chances to speak on that and also opening remarks about the rest of the committee here.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the opportunity to do that. You know, a lot of stories have been shared about Speaker Hortman, and one that hasn't been shared yet is one from when she was at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Many of you may not realize that she worked there. She was in the civil division. At the time, I wasn't running for office or anything. I was just a line attorney doing appeals. And she was at the legislature. She was working in the civil division, yet she wanted to get experience on a criminal case. And so she handled, I don't know if it was worked on a trial, but she definitely worked on an appeal. And she just had a constant curiosity, asked a lot of really good questions about, you know, why would we do certain things, what, you know, and not others. And I just think that's really reflective of her and the fact that we all understand how busy this job is to begin with. And then if you're working another job, but then to go and want to do more in your other job is really quite remarkable. And so I just wanted to share that story because I don't think many people knew that about her. And she really did care a lot about public safety. I know she cared a lot about victim rights and victim services and sexual assault. She put a lot of faith in me to carry a lot of those bills, and I'm really grateful for that. So thanks for that moment. And I'll just say, too, as we start, obviously, we want to work on a bipartisan basis. We have to, right, to get things done. But we also have to recognize the horrible, tragic events that have happened since we were last together. And I really hope that we can all come together, as you said, for the safety of our communities and also making sure that our Constitution and our laws are being upheld. And so that's the standard I'm going to be looking at as we move forward this session. So thank you.
Thank you. The first bill on our agenda is House File 1567. Representative Duran moves House File 1567 before the committee with a recommendation that is placed on the register. While Representative Duran is coming to the testifiers' table with his testifiers, I will remind the committee that we heard this bill last year, amended it, and sent it to Judiciary, where it was further amended. Judiciary returned the bill to Public Safety Committee. Representative Duran, before your testimony, I understand you have an author's technical amendment coded A4 that updates the effective dates of the bill. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, sir.
All in favor of adopting the author's amendment A4, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Duran, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for allowing me to bring this back to you guys. This is a very important bill with everything that's going on within the state of Minnesota, especially with law enforcement. This is just an added extra precaution for law enforcement and data privacy. This bill is allowing their personal information to become private and allowing that extra protection for law enforcement. This is going to help us in the future. It's also increasing some penalties again, and then making sure that we're protecting those. What this bill does not do, okay, does not cover any federal officers. This is a state bill. It does not have any effect on federal officers at all. And it does not restrict publishing real property records as well. I want to just make that clear. So with that, we can move on to testifiers. Again, Mr. Chair.
Looks like we'll start with Sheriff Eric Klang from Crow Wing County. Next up, Jay Henthorne. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Eric Klang. Ready? All right. Thank you. Chairs, member of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I appear before you to express my strong support for the proposed legislation enhancing protections for personal information of public safety officers. This bill is not abstract. It addresses real and immediate threats faced by men and women who protect our communities. I would like to share a recent incident that illustrates exactly why these protections are urgently needed. On the evening of January 26, a public safety officer, Deputy Matt Jorgens of the Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office, was at home with his family, which included his children. The next morning, he was scheduled to appear in court as a key witness in a narcotics case involving the possession of a significant amount of methamphetamine. After the household had settled in for the night and the lights were turned off, a male individual arrived unexpectedly at the deputy's home and knocked loudly on the door. Demonstrating caution, Deputy Jorgens chose not to open the door And instead, he asked through the wall what the visitor wanted. The man claimed to be that he had run out of gas while riding a snowmobile. Through a kitchen window, the deputy observed that the individual was not dressed for snowmobiling, and the explanation did not appear credible due to the extreme cold temperatures of that evening. The deputy instructed the person to leave his property, and his spouse immediately dialed 911. Responding officers located and apprehended the individual shortly thereafter. Pursuant to a search warrant executed on the vehicle, investigators discovered a handwritten note containing Deputy Jorgen's name and address, as well as a loaded 9mm handgun. Based on the evidence, it was clear that the individual had intentionally sought out the deputy's residence. The threat was direct, targeted, and real. I have no doubt in my mind that that individual was there to kill Deputy Matt Jorgens. This incident underscores the vulnerability public safety officers face when their personal information, particularly their home addresses, can be located and misused. Officers routinely engage with individuals who may hold a motive of retaliation. When their private information is exposed, the danger extends not only to the officers themselves, but also to their spouse, to their children, and to the household. The legislation before you creates critical safeguards. It restricts the public posting, sale, and dissemination of personal information of peace officers and correction officers. It ensures that such information held by government entities is treated as private data. It establishes a clear process for officers to request the removal of personal information posted online, and it enhances accountability for those who knowingly expose officers to harm. These protections are not merely beneficial, they are essential. The risk facing public safety officers have increased, and their families are too often placed in the crosshairs of those wishing to obstruct justice or retaliate against lawful enforcement actions. The time to act is now. Members, this bill protects the people that protect us. Strengthening the privacy and the safety of public safety officers is not only a matter of policy, it is a matter of ensuring that these officers can continue to serve without fear that their personal information will be weaponized against them and their families. I urge you to support this important legislation. I thank you for consideration, and certainly would answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Next up will be Chief Henthorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Henthorn. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Richfield. I'm here today speaking as the current president of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, who represents more than 300 police chiefs across the state of Minnesota and over 150 command staff members. We would like to thank Representative Duran for bringing this bill forward, as we feel there is a need for this type of legislation. I'm here today to express the MCPA's strong support of this important legislation to protect the personal information of our public safety officers. Peace officers and correction officers dedicate their lives to protecting our communities. Every day, they make difficult decisions, intervene in dangerous situations, and uphold the rule of law. But in doing so, they often become targets, not just professionally, but personally. This bill addresses a growing and serious threat, the online dissemination of personal information, commonly known as doxing. When a public safety officer's home address, phone number, children's names, or even their children's school is published online, it puts the entire family at risk. It invites harassment, it invites intimidation, and in the worst cases, it invites violence. The legislation creates a clear, narrow, and carefully balanced framework. First, it defines personal information specifically and thoughtfully. Residential addresses, non-work contact information, children's names, and school locations. It does not sweep broadly. It does not eliminate public records. It protects what should never be weaponized against a family. Second, it prohibits knowingly posting or selling this information online. That is a reasonable boundary. We are not talking about restricting lawful speech or investigative journalism. In fact, the bill explicitly protects news reporting, commentary, matters of public concern, and it also preserves access to publicly available government records and respects federal laws such as the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Driver's License Privacy Protection Act, and HIPAA. This is not about secrecy. It's about safety. This bill also ensures that legitimate commercial, financial, healthcare, and law enforcement uses of information remain intact. It carefully lists exceptions so that businesses, credit agencies, insurers, and public institutions can continue lawful operations without disruption. What this legislation does is simple. It draws a line between transparency and targeted harm. Public safety officers do not surrender their right to personal scrutiny or security when they put on the Badger uniform. Their spouses and children certainly did not sign up for exposure or threats. Protecting their home addresses and family information does not reduce accountability. It reduces risk. At a time when tensions can run high and online platforms can amplify personal information instantly to thousands, even millions of people, we must modernize our protections. This bill reflects that reality. If we expect men and women to continue to serve in law enforcement and corrections, we must ensure that their families are not collateral damage. This legislation sends a clear message. Minnesota values transparency, but it also values safety. We can protect both. For these reasons, the MCPA supports House File 1567. Thank you for your time today and allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Chief. Next up will be Dave Titus, Executive Director, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. Up after him will be Mike Ledoux, Legislative Affairs Director, Law Enforcement Labor Services. If you could go to the podium also, Mr. Ledoux. State your name and begin your testimony.
David Titus, I'm the MPPA Executive Director. Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, committee members. And seriously, thank you for your commitment for the important work of leading public safety. We do appreciate you. We do appreciate everything you do for us. We expect our police officers to step up and respond to emotionally charged, dangerous calls for service. Many times, someone at those 911 calls is having a bad day. Not everyone will be happy with that call's outcome. Cops accept risk and are very aware that some misguided individuals will blame them, the officer, and target them for perceived wrongs by using and sharing personal information. This happens. This is dangerous. We, society, in return, should do what we can to protect our public servants and their families by reducing risk. The MPPA represents police and peace officers. It's in our name. We ask respectfully that you support House File 1567.
Mr. Ledoux. Up after him will be Chad Thiesing.
Chair Novotny.
Please state your name.
The committee.
Please state your name for the record again. I'm sorry.
Mike Ledoux, L-E, capital B-O-U-X. Chair Novotny, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ledoux. I serve as the Director of the Legislative Affairs for Law Enforcement Labor Services, and I retired in August after serving 31 years as a Minnesota State Trooper. LELS represents more than 8,800 public safety professionals across Minnesota, including peace officers and correctional officers. I am here in support of House File 1567. This bill is about protecting Minnesota public safety professionals and, just as importantly, their families. Everyday officers leave their homes to serve communities across the state. When they are out in the field protecting the public, their families should not be placed at risk because sensitive personal information can be easily accessed and misused. We know how quickly home addresses, personal phone numbers, email addresses, and even information about children can be shared online. That kind of exposure creates a real safety concern. It opens the door to harassment, intimidation, and retaliation that reach beyond the individual officer. House File 1567 provides a practical and a balanced solution. It allows public safety officers, including correctional officers, to request that certain sensitive personal information held by government entities is treated as private data. These protections already exist for judicial officials, extending similar safeguards to public safety officers simply recognizes the risks inherent to their work. Public safety officers accept the risks that come with serving our communities. What they should not have to accept is that their family safety can be compromised at home while they are out protecting others. I don't mind sharing a personal experience I had when I had about a decade on the job. A person I had dealt with in an enforcement capacity related to narcotics decided one day to come to my residence and drive over my 4x4 mailbox. While it seems insignificant, it very much angered me, of course. Fortunately, my colleagues from the Duluth Police Department were able to track that individual down. But any time I was on night shift, I don't need to tell you the mental things that played out in my spouse's mind when I was at work as a result of something as simply coming to my house and running over my mailbox. And I also had a colleague that I worked with in the State Patrol that worked in Carlton County. And he had his squad car burnt to the ground in his driveway. So I don't need to tell you, I would imagine, how that made his family feel as well when he went to work. So anything we could do to safeguard our families while these dedicated public safety professionals are doing what we ask them to do would be greatly appreciated. And I thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you, Mr. Ledoux. Mr. Thiesing.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Committee. I'm Chad Pessing. I'm a conservation officer of the state of Minnesota for the last 20 years. Prior to that, I had 10 years police experience. I was personally doxed this Christmas. While doing my job as a conservation officer, I conducted a deer farm inspection. The farmer videoed it and put that on social media. Through that output, it generated 4,000 to 6,000 comments, most of which were negative towards me. A lot of were violent towards me and my family. Several times my address was listed in these comments, and a lot of talk was generated about certain days we're going to come and show up at your house, video your house, fly drones to your windows, things of that nature. As a conservation officer and as a police officer in general, I can deal with a lot of that, knowing how to deal with stuff like that, but my family does not. Very taxing on my wife, who's a teacher. It was during Christmas break. She had a week or two off and couldn't really enjoy it because she was always looking out the windows and concerned, when are they coming? Because they talked that they will come. They're just going to let, you know, we're going to gather and do it. So it's not even so much for me, but my wife and my kids. It was very hard on them. She ended up going out and buying several cameras and posting them around the area. So please consider this bill. I think it would be great for officers in general. It's hard enough to get police officers the way it stands. So I thank you for considering this bill, and please support it.
Thank you, Mr. Thiesing. Last testifier is Rich Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, come to the table, state your name, begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. This is my first time testifying on this bill. This bill, I think, needs substantial rework. I'm going to highlight some of the reasons why. First of all, this will have an impact on 15,000 plus employees. Secondly, when you say that the data becomes private, it becomes private immediately once the law takes effect. But for the remedies and the penalties to take effect, you have to do a claim. There's a disconnect here. Number three, some of the concerns that I have is that it erodes transparency for those exercising the coercive state power, which law enforcement can do, risks concealing conflicts of interest or corruption, and offers the bill as reads a fallacy of enhanced protection. The thing is that it's important to realize that when you talk about children and all, a lot of that data is already protected. And when you look at the bill, you'll see the various nuances on how it plays. And one of those things, the fallacy is the broad exemptions that you're offering. And at the same time, how easy it is in the private sector. There needs to be a broad discussion so that there can be a balance. And a number of states have done that. Whether or not, Mr. Chair, if the author has done that, I do not know. But this is the first time where I have seen the bill, and I know MnNOG has, which is separate from me, but we sometimes parallel on the same issues, has also stated. So I can go in detail if there's questions, but I want you only gave me a couple minutes, so I wanted to be able to say, highlight, there are some real issues here. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you.
And under time, thank you, Mr. Newman. Members, questions for Representative Duran. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Duran. I know we've chatted a lot back and forth about this bill, and I appreciate the dialogue that we've had on it. And so questions I have for you are no surprise, but just so that folks have kind of followed along with what you and I have talked about. I know, so the prior testifier from LELS said that they represent over 8,800 people, and that's just their group. So how many people, roughly, would this bill cover, if you have that answer?
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would actually cover somewhere around that, 15,000, I would say, roughly. So.
Okay.
Representative Curran.
Thank you. Let's see, and I appreciate that you pointed out in the offset that this doesn't apply to federal officers. This really is meant to, we're looking at those who serve the state of Minnesota. I appreciate that you clarified that at the outset. I know that this conversation has definitely highlighted that a wide variety of Minnesotans want to feel safe and secure in their homes. Even and especially police officers, right? And so I think in the greater context of what people are seeing and being fearful in their own homes, we have to, just look at how those fears might apply in our own lives and then sort of look at the perspective of other people and how they might feel similar fears and in similar contexts. But I wanted to just touch on the real property piece. A couple folks mentioned that that's not in this bill. I think Sheriff Klang's testimony right away was compelling enough. The other testifiers were great, but I think that alone was such a powerful story. Could you talk a little bit about why this bill in particular doesn't address property records?
Representative Duran.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. thank you for that question. It is because is a lot of information and a lot of people at this point in time. And, having to work through that situation, I think is going to take a wider discussion to figure out how we can, make sure as a whole we can accompany this. This bill, obviously, is a step forward to protecting our law enforcement officers. Does it do everything? No, it doesn't. Would I like it to have more? Absolutely. But I think at this point in time, with the discussions we've had and where we feel comfortable, I think this is a good starting point for us.
Representative Curran.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. And yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate that this conversation is ongoing, that this is considered a step. And I know that likely in other committees we'll talk about data privacy protections for other vulnerable groups as well, based on positions they might serve in. And I think this is just a good chance to sort of soft launch the conversations that we might be having further into the legislative session. But that is a conversation to be continued, because there really are concerns about data that should remain private, especially when it comes to our own homes, whether you're a police officer, a judge, an elected official, all kinds of things, right? So I hope that we continue this conversation, and I hope that we can work together toward a better solution for specifically managing the property record piece of it, because it is such a heavy lift. It was a lot to get it for judges, but it's because it's so many people. So hopefully we can work toward, I don't know if we're looking at an office of data privacy or what kind of resources we're looking at, but I hope we continue that and get that protection. Thank you.
Representative Duran, response?
I'm willing to keep those conversations going, so thank you.
Co-Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Duran, for bringing the bill. I am planning on supporting it today. I just had a couple of thoughts, though, as the testifiers were talking. You know, first, I'm really sorry for anybody who was doxxed or had that experience of someone showing up at their home. We know what that's like, right? And so this is very triggering for us, and I just wanted to say that out loud. I think there's a lot of discomfort in it, because we've experienced that in a very real way ourselves in June. Also, I had some discomfort hearing some of the stories, because what was happening to law enforcement is happening to people who live in our communities. And so one of the stories was about the roofs of somebody with a broken snowmobile. We just heard that somebody was pretending, ICE was pretending to have a broken car, and they, out under ruse, got people to come out of their house, and then they snatched that man. We heard about, a testifier talked about the sanctity of children's schools and locations. We have experienced ICE around our schools and taking parents on pickup and drop off. I know people across the aisle maybe feel like this shouldn't be, you know, I shouldn't be bringing this up now, but I just want to appeal to your, whatever attracts you to this bill and those privacy considerations, I hope appeals to you when we're talking about that when it comes to other people as well. Another testifier talked about harassment and intimidation and retaliation. We know that individuals who are constitutional observers are being harassed. They're being driven back to their houses. They've got ICE agents sitting outside of their houses. They're being told, and we've seen it on video, that they're going on some list. Another story about someone threatening to fly drones outside your window. There's been really heavy drone activity in my community over the last several days, in many communities across the state. And so, again, I support this bill, but all of those things that you're talking about, you wanting privacy for law enforcement, which we want for law enforcement, we want for public officials, but every Minnesotan deserves that same level of protection and privacy. And so I just needed to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Duran, closing comments.
I really appreciate the dialogue back and forth with everybody. This bill, like I said, is a work in progress. We'd like to have more discussions on this, and thank you for your support.
With that, I renewed Representative Duran's motion that House File 1567, as amended, be placed in the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion carries, and House File 1567, as amended, is referred to the general register. Thank you, Representative Duran, and your testifiers. The next bill to come to the agenda is House File 2809. Representative Hudson, please come to the table with your testifiers. Representative Hudson moves House File 2809 before the committee with a recommendation is placed in the general register. Representative Hudson, before you begin your testimony, I understand you have an author's amendment coded A1 that updates the effective bill date. Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
And the amendment just states we're moving from 2025 to 2026. All in favor of adopting the author's amendment A1, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, signify by saying nay. Motion prevails and A1 is adopted. Representative Hudson, explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, Chair Moeller and members. House File 2809 is about a simple principle. Every single one of us has residents of this state and denizens of the United States have both a moral and constitutionally protected right to the peaceful enjoyment of our property, particularly our homes. Home is where we retreat for respite, for restoration, for our most cherished relationships. Home is where we raise our children, care for our spouses, and for those of us who are so inclined, enjoy our beloved pets. It's said that home is where the heart is, and that's true. Our homes provide our peace. Our homes are our why. What we do here, we do to protect what we hold sacred at home. Unfortunately, while the vast majority of our neighbors continue to respect this principle, and our culture has traditionally regarded the home as a sacred space not to be violated by disruptive or coercive activity, there are few bad actors operating on the outer fringe of our society who've decided to opt out of common decency. In recent years, we've seen a troubling trend. Coercive agitators cloaked in the guise of activism deliberately targeting private residences, not to persuade, not to make a credible argument, but to intimidate the individuals and families who reside there along with their entire community. We've seen agitators camp outside Mayor Jacob Frey's home in Minneapolis. We saw a mob gather outside the home of a police officer and his wife, who worked as a member of the press, burning them in effigy and explicitly threatening to burn their entire city to the ground. And late in 2024, activists publicly threatened to create a disturbance at my own residence, and I know many other members have had similar experiences. That is not democratic discourse. That's not a conversation. That's not debate. That is personal intimidation. HF 2809 simply establishes that bringing a protest to someone's dwelling crosses the line into criminal conduct. It does this narrowly and constitutionally. First, it does not in any way ban or prohibit the petition for redress of grievance. There are a myriad ways in the modern world for people to express their discontent with either policy or personalities. People can protest at the Capitol. They can protest at City Hall. They can protest outside businesses and public officials' offices. But there are constitutionally recognized and longstanding time, place, and manner restrictions, and one of those restrictions properly ought to be each of our homes. Second, this approach is firmly grounded in Supreme Court precedent. In Frisbee versus Schultz, the court held that focused picketing at a residence may be prohibited because the home holds a unique place in our constitutional tradition. Third, the bill includes sensible limits, does not apply where a residence is also a business or public meeting place, such as the governor's mansion. And in the finest constitutional tradition, this bill protects everyone equally, be they police officers, judges, healthcare workers, private citizens, or elected officials. Anyone who becomes the target of coercive agitation is protected by this bill. We all deserve peace in our homes. HF 2809 draws that boundary clearly and lawfully. I ask for your support.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hudson. Are there any testifiers in the chamber that would like to speak with us? All right. Members, Representative Curran.
Sure, thank you. I appreciate the conversation, and I'm going to shock everybody by saying, Representative Hudson, I agree with you on some of the words that you said today, in that our right to protest, our constitutional rights, that the constitutional rights we have to free speech and express the things that we are not happy about is not what's happened at some events where people have shown up at homes. And we've already established we're very familiar with this. People have shown up not to persuade, but to intimidate and threaten people. And that is real. That is very real. That is very recent. And I think I could probably speak for everybody in saying that type of behavior is not what we're talking about when we're talking about protesting. What I do notice, though, is that in this particular bill, this bill isn't addressing intimidating or threatening behavior. We're not talking specifically about coercion. I'm concerned with constitutionality because of how simple the language is. I think that the idea that you're getting at here, that those of us who are elected officials, we had the conversation about peace officers. When people show up because they're mad about something, they're not necessarily trying to change your mind all the time. They're trying to make you feel something, and that something that you feel could be fear. And I've had this argument with press folks, too, that no, I didn't give you an invitation to my home, so no, it's not okay to show up. If you do show up, it feels like a threat. And because I feel like a threat, like it's a threat, it is one. Period. Look at the events of June 14th. You don't have to look any further. You don't get to show up at people's houses unannounced. That being said, my concerns again are with the simplicity of the language, because it says a person who protests before or about the residence or dwelling of any person. And I've got constituents who live on busy roads and like to stand at the end of their own driveway with their own one-person protest on their own property, and I'm not confident that this protects their right to do so. So that would be one of my primary concerns with this, other than I think just the generality as it is, I think, I don't think it would hold up to constitutional muster.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran. I appreciate your thoughtful, sincere, and nuanced expression of your concern about the right to privacy and the right to protest. These are important things to sort out. Let me walk you through my thinking of why this makes sense. First of all, this concept of people protesting at their own homes is something that I was introduced to today. It's nothing I've ever seen before. Protesting your own house seems like an odd activity, but apparently that's something certain people are interested in doing. If language exempting that or more closely specifying the type of activity that we're looking to prohibit would be acceptable to the other side of the aisle, I'd be more than happy to consider that. But I want to address this underlying conflation that I see, particularly expressed in the letter from the ACLU. And this is a pretty common, what I regard to be fallacious conflation of two completely, entirely different concepts. One being the right to protest, the right to petition your government for redress or grievance, and the right to do literally anything else. And it has become quite common for people to engage in activity which is disruptive, perhaps even illegal, and then try to appeal to their right to protest and petition as a shield for that activity. So, for an example, were I out to go walk out into the middle of the street and just physically obstruct traffic, that's a crime. I would be dealt with by law enforcement. But if I were to do so while holding up a sign with some contrived political message on it, now, according to some folks, that's a protected activity. Well, what changed? The effect of the underlying crime remains. It is still an illegal activity, and engaging in a constitutionally protected activity adjacent to that prohibited activity does not provide you with protection for the underlying crime. And yet that has become an all too common defense for folks who are engaged in behavior that, if you were to divorce it from their political messaging, would certainly result them in engaging with law enforcement, and appropriately so. So the question of residential protesting in terms of people showing up to your house in order to make their voice heard, the question I would have for folks who are interested in doing that is, why do you have to do it at somebody's house? If indeed your intention is merely to express your opinion about policy or personalities, to have your voice heard, to make a statement that's geared toward persuasion in our democratic process, then what does the added element of going to their house achieve that you can't achieve online, in front of City Hall, in front of the Capitol, literally anywhere else? And the only intelligible answer I can conceive of for that question is that your intention is to send the subtext that we know where you live. And that message is meant to be received not just by you, but by your family, and by your neighbors, and by everybody connected to you. And the purpose of sending that message is to coerce political decisions. And that is not how we do things in the United States of America or the state of Minnesota. We do not engage in coercive political activity. We engage in persuasive political activity. The mere act of going to somebody's house is inherently coercive, especially when tied to some demand for certain political outcomes. That is why I'm comfortable with the language as it stands, but again, I am willing to consider amendments that would address the concerns raised by the other side.
Follow up, Representative Corinne.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Hudson. I still like the sort of the meat of the issue here, I think we're in a lot of agreement on, in just sort of how this discourse plays out in the public and people showing up at each other's houses. I mean, I won't repeat what you said, but I agree with a lot of the sentiment that you have on this idea. When it comes to, you know, the basic concept that the Constitution protects, I say us, when I say us, I mean the people, the residents of the United States of America. The Constitution protects residents from government. And I caution us as a government body telling residents that they don't have a right to protest us in their own yard or in their own home. We could talk about, you know, showing up at somebody else's place uninvited. Based on the position that person holds, I think that's a different conversation. But I think this bill in particular, it's really that basic constitutional concept that as residents, as citizens, the Constitution is supposed to protect us from our government. And when you tell constituents that they can no longer hold up a sign of however they feel about ICE as ICE drives by, they have a right to do that in their own yard. Not blocking traffic, not disrupting anything. But I have constituents who live along prominent, travel pathways in my district, and they use the time that they have available in their day to protest the government, as is their right, and they do so on their own property. So that's really my concern with this, is that I just don't think it's getting at the issue that we're talking about here.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again, Representative Coran. Again, sounds like a simple fix. Sounds like something we could absolutely address with an amendment to specify that constitutionally protected activities that occur in a place where you have the right to be are not intended to be impeded by this legislation. Perhaps that's the clause. We can turn to staff to figure out the best way to address that. Again, there's no intention here of saying that you can't have a sign in your yard. By God, how would we even campaign, right? This is very much about coercive, disruptive activity of the type that you know when you see. And the reason why I'm fairly confident that this, if this was passed as it is, it would not be in any way prohibitive of the type of personal activity you're describing, is because there would be no victim to complain. How do you complain about somebody doing something in your own property when you own it and it's your property? But be that as it may, tightening the language in order to affect that intent is something I'm in 100% agreement with.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Hudson. I think that there's, I think there would be great agreement about what I believe you intend. I mean, a great concern that is shared about what I believe you intend here. I think the concern with the bill as drafted is that it either covers conduct that is already criminalized, or it goes much broader than what you are describing and intending. And I actually found it very, it was interesting, the example you gave. You said, if somebody blocks traffic, they violate the law. But if they do so holding a sign, well, now some people are saying they're not breaking the law. No, we look at conduct. They're still breaking the law. Now, they may choose to break the law in that way because of a long tradition we have of civil disobedience and recognizing there are greater injustices, going all the way back to flipping over the table of the money changers in the temple, right? Probably breaking some laws there. I'm kind of mindful of this today. Because of broader injustice. But it doesn't mean that the law was not broken. So we look at conduct. And what concerns me in looking at your bill is the conduct that you're prohibiting is, first of all, protesting. There's no definition. What is protesting? What does it mean if somebody protests in your bill that a court's going to apply it?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. If somebody's on your property, on or about your property, and they're standing there making a disruption and holding signs, I mean, we all recognize what protest is. Now, if you want to define it further, that's fine. The effect that we're getting after here is the intention is not what I would call either welcome or legitimate. Welcome and legitimate interactions are what should be taking place in our homes, people who we want to be there, people who we've invited to be there. And if we don't want people there, then they need to depart. And you're right. There is existing law that could affect this. We have trespass laws. Unfortunately, in order for those to take effect immediately, we would all have to have trespass postings in our front yards, and I don't think that's something we want to see in our neighborhoods. What if we're not home and there's activity taking place? What if our children are alone at home and there's activity taking place and nobody there who can respond to it appropriately? There's also the crime of disturbing the peace, which could be enforced. Unfortunately, again, I think that this premise is very common in our current political discourse where we, under the fear of treading upon the First Amendment, we're unwilling to hold people accountable for the conduct that is objectively illegal under the law. I recall a conversation that I had with my city attorney when I was serving on the city council in Albertville along these lines related to the BLM protests that were taking place without permits, blocking streets. And we were very clearly advised, you can go back and watch it on tape, that you may in fact be violating people's First Amendment rights to uphold the laws as written because they are correlated to protest activity, to speech. That's the type of problem I'm talking about. If that's the way our attorneys and our law enforcement and our prosecutors are interpreting current law, then more specificity is required.
Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Hudson, if this becomes law and I charge it and I'm in front of a jury, the judge has to give instructions to the jury as to the meaning of the word protest. What you just said, that's a very, very, very long jury instruction. So I guess one thing I heard you say early on, like, are signs necessary? Like, if somebody doesn't have a sign, so I'll assume that's a no, or I'm hearing a no. So it sounds like what I'm hearing you say is if somebody comes to your home and they are not welcome to be there, and maybe you didn't say these words, but sort of like, and they have some message for you in some way that they want you to hear, and it's unwelcome by you. Is that a protest?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. This is why I think it's important to have as broad a definition as possible, because if somebody is engaging, delivering a message, what, are they handing me an envelope? Are they talking to me respectfully? That's not a protest. A protest of a domicile is going to involve encroachment upon that property for the purpose of very explicitly engaging in antagonistic communication. That's what protest is. The whole purpose is to express distaste with the target of your protest. That is not an appropriate activity at people's homes.
just isn't.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Representative Hudson, I'm trying to get my head around this a little bit. So if somebody's giving you like serving process to you, for example, like you have to appear, a subpoena to appear in court, and you do not want to appear there, you think the whole thing is completely just a total scam, right? They've got this thing, they're handing it over. So is that a protest? Seems like from what you said that would be. Just trying to understand the limits of your definition.
Representative Hutt.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, Representative Pinto. Obviously, engaging in any sort of lawful activity would not be considered a protest. So providing service, a service process, is a lawful activity. A officer of the law effecting a warrant or doing a welfare check, that is a lawful activity. You're not required to welcome that. The other word that I used was legitimate. Those are legitimate activities. Showing up to somebody's house to scare their children, such as what happened to me last Friday, where I wasn't home for a couple of minutes, and I was a couple blocks away, and I get a frantic call from my kid, and he's clutching a knife in the kitchen, and I have to direct him to an interior space of the house, and then show up and figure out what's going on. That is not an appropriate activity, the way that was carried out, even though it was cloaked in legitimate purpose. There should be standards for how we engage with each other, particularly at our homes.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hudson, may I just say that behavior you described, completely unacceptable, of course. I think we're all mindful of our families and our lives, and I'm so sorry that your family experienced that. And I say genuinely, I would hope you would know, I and my colleagues, I think all of us are shared in wanting to make sure that we are all of us in Minnesota, not just in elective office, not just law enforcement, all of us are safe in our homes and safe in everything that we're doing. I have significant concerns about how this is drafted, and maybe I will just note, maybe just ask you at this point, there is currently a prohibition on targeted residential picketing, right? And also a prohibition on harassment and stalking. What is the gap in the law that is missing right now in terms of our current law, those current laws?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. Again, I would argue that there isn't a gap in the law as such. There is a gap in the way the law is being interpreted by the people who are tasked with enforcing it, whether they are law enforcement officers or prosecutors, and certainly folks who are advising others to engage in, and perhaps even organizing and funding, targeted residential protest activities, where in spite of the fact that it is currently illegal to disturb the peace, currently illegal to block people's access to their property, currently illegal to harass people in their homes, again, there's this hesitation that I have seen firsthand, and I think we've all seen, from prosecutors and law enforcement to take appropriate action. I mean, we saw it right here in this chamber last year, early on, right? We had a couple dozen people lined up. We were sitting over there where you guys are, and they're right behind us, and all of a sudden they all stand up and engage in what is a crime under Minnesota statute. Disturbing the legislature is a crime. You can go to jail for it. Yeah, you would never know that because it doesn't happen. And the reason, and that's the problem, is merely having the thing on paper isn't enough. You have to have a clear understanding in the public, and certainly amongst the people who are tasked with enforcing it, of what the expectation is. And so what this does is it clarifies legislative intent. It takes all of those existing prohibitions and says, this is what we mean. This is one of the areas where you don't get to behave that way.
Mr. Chair, I'll end with this just to say let me think here. I guess I want to circle back to what I said at the beginning, is that we need to focus on conduct. Our law focuses on conduct. If you, Representative Hudson, are concerned about laws just written on paper and the folks interpreting them, this is also written on paper. If you lack that faith, then I don't know what changing laws does, right? So either way, there's going to be some laws that are written. And what I'm hearing you say is that our current laws actually do adequately cover this. The issue is those interpreting the laws and enforcing the laws. We'll have that conversation. We have got to focus on conduct. And as another illustration of the gap here, you heard about, you know, protesting in front of one's own home. I'll just note, this is talking about protesting around or before or about residents, just a group that is walking down the street, as have been the protests against ICE, community members themselves expressing what's happening in their community. As they pass in front of anybody's home, that is a violation of how this is written. So this is the way this is drafted is really problematic. Let's continue to work together to go after conduct, to identify it clearly and prohibit it, and happy to work with you as a prosecutor myself to then to make sure we follow through and make sure that's enforced in that way, to make sure that everybody in our state is safe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. I hate sitting here because I can't look at you while I'm talking to you, but thank you. I just have a couple of questions. I guess I'll put two of them together. So one, what is a residence or dwelling when it comes to things like Airbnbs? Does that count? Because it says unless it's being used as a business, and Airbnbs are being used as a business, right? So that's one question. And the second one is, it's not clear to me from this language whether you have to be on the property. The sidewalks in most cities are owned by the city, not owned by the person. And sidewalks are public property. We know this because we had long conversations about cannabis usage on public property, on city property, as opposed to in one's own property. And so my concern is when you're saying you cannot protest in front of someone's residence, but the protest is in the street or on the sidewalk or they're going somewhere, does that count as a protest on the person's residence? So I'll stop there and then I've got one more.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair Devaney, and thank you, Representative Hollins. So I'll address the first point first. So you bring up a great example, Airbnb. My hope would be that that would be covered, and perhaps that's another amendment worth considering, because, again, the purpose of, even though that is a business as such, the purpose of showing up in a domicile-like space to engage in coercive political activity is precisely the sort of thing that this bill is intended to address. So perhaps there's a gap there that needs to be filled. And I really appreciate you bringing up this concept of public property. This is another one of the, what I regard as fallacies that seem so popular in our political discourse today. It's public property, so I can do whatever I want. When has that ever been true anywhere? You go to the park, they got a sign there that says, these are all the things you can and cannot do. These are the posted hours. You go to a library, you fall asleep in the corner, they're kicking you out. You don't get to say, oh, it's public property, so as a member of the public, I just get to do whatever. We have prescribed public uses for our public property. It's why there's a fence with razor wire around the airport, right? And so merely citing the fact that you're standing on the sidewalk or you're standing in the street, again, just like with holding the sign in my previous example, the fact that you're in a public space does not translate to license to engage in disruptive criminal activity. So if the purpose of what you're doing on the sidewalk or in the street is to engage in intimidation and political coercion, yeah, that should be illegal. And indeed it is. And again, this is a problem with enforcement. This notion that keeps getting tossed up of, oh, what if there's 100 people who want to walk down your street to protest? Well, do they have a permit to do so? Have neighbors been notified? I mean, I got to get permits. Again, I was on a city council. People have to get permits to, like, have a party for their kids. Give neighbor notices that this is coming and you might want to be ready for it. You got to do that as the person who lawfully lives on the abode, but we're just going to allow strangers to just go down disrupting the neighborhood randomly because they decided so? None of this is novel. Now, I realize it counters a lot of the current narratives of what is considered legitimate protest activity, but that's precisely the type of thing that I'm trying to end. We should be safe and at peace in our homes, not subject to somebody else's disruptive whims.
Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. So as I understand it, then, you are basically saying that not just targeted protesting of an individual in front of their house, you're effectively saying that all protests in residential areas would be illegal.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deferring to Representative Pinto's previous point, it's already illegal. It's illegal to block the street, right? It's illegal. Sidewalk. Okay.
Let's keep our.
So 100 people are going to just meter down the sidewalk, center file. Yeah. Okay. Sure. That's how these things manifest. This is another thing I've noticed in the kind of the broader public conversation about this is that the hypotheticals have to get more and more absurd for the argument against the policy to continue. This is not how protest actually manifests. It manifests in an intentionally disruptive process intended to prohibit people from being able to go about their business in peace. 100 people on the road is an illegal obstruction. That's why you have to have a permit for a parade. Why do these rules only apply to the people who are willing to abide by the law and they don't apply to people who have a political grievance? As long as the right kind of grievance, they get to do whatever they want. That's exactly what I'm pushing back against.
Representative Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how to respond to that because it is exactly what I'm talking about. There's a reason why we had to have discussions about where cannabis usage was allowed, because it is public property and there are rules around it. And when you have this broadly worded piece of legislation that is saying that it is illegal, and protests do happen on the sidewalk, maybe not in the suburbs, but in the cities they certainly do. And I'm really not trying to like throw a loophole or something. I'm really just trying to understand what your goal is. But I'm going to move on from that because I liked a lot of the words that you were using: antagonistic communication, coercive acts, that people who come to your house should be welcome and legitimate. And at the risk of going a little off topic here, as a person who was followed by ICE to my home that they looked up and told that they know where I live and that I better watch myself, it is hard for me to see that being reflected in the words you're using, and yet nobody has come to me and said, yeah, that was wrong. That was coercive. That was, antagonistic communication. Like, this is something that they were doing to intimidate me. And I am curious if what you are putting into law or what you are hoping to put into law would apply to federal agents.
Representative Hutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Holland. The short answer is no. And the reason why is, of course, the Supremacy Clause of the United States, which under the enumerated powers that the states grant to the federal government, which include immigration law and immigration enforcement, the state of Minnesota has no jurisdiction to place restrictions upon the activity of federal law enforcement officers. The second reason would be that as a broad category, law enforcement has rights that the rest of us don't in order to enable them to affect their role of enforcing the law. Now, you want to get into the specifics of what you describe and how you were treated, we can perhaps find meaningful agreement on the inappropriateness of some of those elements. Absolutely. I would not conflate legitimate law enforcement action with residential protesting.
Representative Owens.
I'm sorry, Chair Novotny.
I'm just hoarse.
What's that?
I said it just sore throat.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, Representative Hudson. I appreciate that sentiment. And I guess I would say, yeah, the big difference is the people who were in front of my house have full body armor and are seriously armed. And you're talking about people with signs.
Representative Hudson.
I don't have a response to that. Would you like me to close, or were there more member questions?
We have other testifiers. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to read the language of the harassment statute, because I really think, like, I'm, you know, former ACLU of Minnesota board member, kind of First Amendment purist, also a legislator who has experienced a lot of fear over this interim, so I understand what you are getting at here. But I do believe that the language that we have in law is really good. So targeted residential picketing, which is considered harassment, includes marching, standing, or patrolling by one or more persons directed solely at a particular residential building in a manner that adversely affects the safety, security, or privacy of an occupant of the building. And then, or, and it includes, like, same type of activity, but like making it hard for you to access your home. I like that language because it talks about it being directed solely at a particular residential building. And that gets us out of any point of confusion over, like, spatially, where are you? Are you walking by? Are you on your own property? You know. So I would suggest that if you're concerned that the state of the law is not adequate, like it's not being enforced adequately or understood adequately by law enforcement, I would, rather than this very broad language, I think that we could amend the existing harassment statute to try to achieve your goals. And so that was what I wanted to suggest. Thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. It's an intriguing idea. Let's talk about it.
Representative Woody.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. To get to Representative Curran's question, there's a possibility of throwing on the first subdivision or section one, subdivision one, where it says dwelling of any person may be put other. So it's not, it's identifying that it's not your, if you're out in your own property, that's fine. It's going to other people's property. And the example I will give is the late Pete Orbit. After he was given a case, he got picketed and stalked around his house, and his neighbors couldn't get through the neighborhood. So I think we clearly know what we're talking about when it's targeted and compared to non-targeted. So I appreciate the efforts. I'm just trying to help clarify it. Seems like you're willing to work through it, but I do remember that what happened to him at that time, and it affected him, his family, his neighbors, and he was just trying to do his job. So I think we all are sensitive to it, too, when it could show up in our yard, just because you have a difference of opinion, and that's probably not the best way to handle it. It's through communication. It brings threats. It brings fear. And the laws aren't always foolproof, as we saw here from last session when we were in committee. No charges came from it. And I think as you look at some of these things, you're just trying to fill in the gap. So I appreciate the efforts of bringing up some of the suggestions from our colleagues and then that you're willing to work on this. So thank you, Mr. Hudson.
Co-Chair Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hudson. And I'll just say I knew Pete. I actually worked with Pete Orpit at the Attorney General's office. So it's good to hear his name mentioned. And that was a really unfortunate circumstance. And you do raise a good point. And I think, Representative Hudson, when you brought your bill forward and you started talking about the reasons for it, you really were getting at that targeted residential picketing that's in statute already that Vice Chair Feist mentioned. So I think we all understand that intent, and you'll hear a lot of support from us for that intent. But as others have pointed out, this language is just too broad. A couple of examples. I guess I have a question first. You had mentioned when you opened that the governor's mansion would be an acceptable place for a protest. And I'm just curious where in the language of this bill does that make that the case?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. I anticipated that question. Let me see if I can find the exact line. I believe if you look at line 109 through 111, the language says this section does not prohibit the peaceful protesting of the place of holding a meeting or assembly on premises commonly used to discuss subjects of general public interest. My understanding of that language is that it would apply to the governor's mansion. Frankly, I would be completely fine with protecting the governor's mansion as well, but that's my understanding of the effect of the language as it stands.
Co-Chair Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't think that that language would provide, I think that could be misused, right? Like, I think if you're going to say that applies to the governor's mansion, then it could be expanded to a lot of other situations as well. So I would like to see that tightened up. And but I do think some of these other examples, you know, I'm thinking about some of the sort of peaceful actions that have happened recently and where Renee Good was killed, for example. A lot of people have done vigils. There's a whole singing resistance movement where people sing peaceful songs, and it's not antagonistic, like you mentioned your definition of protest, but yet it's peaceful, and unfortunately she was killed in a neighborhood, a residential neighborhood. I'm thinking of the situation where there was just a couple weeks ago in St. Paul a crash involving ICE, and a bunch of neighbors came out, including a woman in her bathrobe and slippers. Clearly, she was in a residential area when that happened. I mean, I don't think she was walking around the streets of St. Paul in her bathrobe. And so that just happened to take place there, and people came out to record and protest that activity. I'm looking at images for some of the marches that have taken place in Minneapolis, and I believe those were permitted. And down the streets of Minneapolis, of course, there are many residential areas in addition to businesses. And I think the language of your bill is too broad and would incorporate all of those situations as being forbidden. And that's just not something that I can get behind. But if you want to narrow it to get behind some of that targeted activity that you spoke about earlier, I think that is a conversation worth having. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hudson, closing remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Moeller and all members for the robust discussion. I detect sincere, meaningful desire to arrive at a solution. And with that said, I'll just note, I'd like to enter this quote in from Frisbee versus Schultz, the Supreme Court case, where they said, the state's interest in protecting the well-being, tranquility, and privacy of the home is certainly of the highest order. And my understanding is that judges and lawyers are pretty particular about the language that they use in these things. The highest, that means there's no higher. That said, very interested in looking at ways to affect the intent here in a manner that is different than the current proposed language. And for that reason, Mr. Chair, I would change my motion to just ask you to lay the bill over until we can work on it more.
Which is what it was going to be anyway. So
okay.
sounds like you have some work that we can do to make everyone feel safe and comfortable in their residence. With that, House File 2809, as amended, is laid over. The last bill on the agenda is House File 3380. Representative Hudson, since this is still your bill, you can remain at the testifier's table. Your bill may have a cost to the general fund, so we will be laying over the bill today. There are amendments to your bill, but we will allow Representative Hudson to present the bill first. Representative Hudson, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Moeller and members. House File 3380 addresses a very specific and very dangerous group of offenders, people who have repeatedly committed violent felonies with firearms. Minnesota law already recognizes repeat violent offenders as a serious threat, but under the current statute, enhanced sentences for those offenders are optional, and too often they are not applied. And the result is predictable. Chronic violent offenders cycle through the system, receive downward departures, and return to our communities. In fact, sentencing data shows that in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, roughly three-quarters of felony offenders receive some form of downward departure from recommended sentences. House File 3380 addresses that failure directly. This bill says that when someone commits three or more violent felonies involving firearms, the court must impose an aggravated sentence up to the statutory maximum, and that offender must serve the full term. No early release, no probation, no cycling back into the community after repeated armed violence. Members, you may recall I presented a similar bill last year that which had a broader focus on any violent felony. While we weren't able to come to agreement on that proposal, I would certainly hope that this narrower approach, focusing exclusively on those who have habitually committed violent felonies with a firearm, would be met with bipartisan approval. By the time someone commits their third violent felony with a firearm, they have demonstrated beyond any doubt that they pose an ongoing danger to public safety. By contrast, a proposed delete all amendment shifts the focus from serial criminal activity with the firearm to the lawful possession of firearms by law-abiding citizens. The contrast and approach to that issue could not be more clear, but I remain hopeful that protecting the innocent from those proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt on three separate occasions will be a higher priority for this committee than disarming innocent and vulnerable Minnesotans. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, and we have testifier Dave Zimmer. Mr. Zimmer, please go to the table, state your name for the record, and begin.
Chair Novotny and committee members, my name is David Zimmer. I serve 33 years in local law enforcement and have served the past 4 years as the Public Safety Policy Fellow with Center of the American Experiment. In this capacity, I appear today in support of House File 3380, which would improve public safety by ensuring a more consequential criminal justice system. In the past 3 years, I've attended many of the hearings in this committee. There's always been appropriate debate over the best way to address penalties for nonviolent property and drug crimes. And thankfully, this committee has historically found agreement on issues involving crimes of violence. I believe this bill offers you yet another opportunity to find agreement. Agreement that would tighten loopholes currently exploited by violent offenders. Agreement that would reestablish appropriate consequences for committing multiple crimes of violence. An agreement that would help deliver justice to victims of violent crime in our state, a group that is far too often forgotten in our offender-centric system. The strength of this bill, in my assessment, is that it focuses exclusively on violent offenders, not those who have made a single one-time mistake, but on repeated violent offenders and those who use firearms to carry out their violence. This is not a controversial policy. The bill addresses issues in five straightforward sections. First, it strives to codify in statute what the DOC is currently doing by policy, that is making many crimes of violence ineligible for early release as part of the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, MRRA. The DOC appropriately created a list of 61 violent crimes that it has deemed ineligible for their early release program. However, that policy is quietly sunsetting next year, making it important for this body to codify into statute. Sections 2 through 5 of the bill seek to strengthen statute 609.1095, which deals with increased sentences for certain dangerous and repeat felony offenders. I'll note that 609.1095 was created in 1998, following a particularly violent period in our state, not unlike the period we have recently endured in the 2020s. Just as the public has had seen enough of repeat violent offenders cycling through an ineffective system in the mid-1990s, the public today is again weary of that very same revolving door of justice. This file would help slow that revolving door, ensuring those committing repeated crimes of violence are incapacitated, protecting the public while providing correctional authorities the time it takes to make earnest efforts towards rehabilitation. Minnesota continues to be among the states with the lowest imprisonment rates in the nation. We currently imprison 143 per 100,000 people, a rate less than half the national average. Given the revolving door of justice that many victims of violent crime have witnessed in Minnesota, that is a figure that must change. House File 3380 strives to make that change by holding repeat violent offenders accountable, and I urge you to vote in favor of the bill. Thank you.
Are any of the members of the public that wish to testify? I'll get his attention. Mr. Rice, are you here to testify at all? All right. Just want to see if you're paying attention.
He's going
to run out. Members, questions for Representative Hudson and his testifiers? Mr. Pinto, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Hudson, for the discussion about this. So I guess maybe one just general question. Like, are you, I know the general rhetoric about how cases are handled, but I'm wondering, like, can you point to a specific incident, a specific sentencing, a specific something that you can say, you know, and really since you want to require this of judges, even sort of a number of cases you can point to? Like, is there something you can point to specifically?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. Perhaps Mr. Zimmer has access to data as he's taken quite a look at that. My understanding is that in the aggregate, we're talking about a significant percentage of cases. I believe, what was it that I had in my testimony here? 2/3 in Hennepin-Ramsey County. 3/4 of violent felony offenders receive some form of downward departure from recommended sentences. If that's not the case, that would be welcome news, but that's my understanding.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and interestingly, with that statistic, even if that's true, you're actually saying that they should be not getting a departure. And of course, if there is a departure, that's the details are written up. So actually, every one of those sentences, there has to be the reason has to be provided publicly. So actually, there's plenty of opportunity for you and anybody to challenge any one of those sentences. Your bill actually is saying not that people should be avoiding getting a downward departure, that actually be required to get an upward departure. Significant separation of powers concerns there, of course, regarding directing judges in that way. But I guess I just sort of, before we get into the concerns about the language, just sort of conceptually, every one of those cases you should be able to bring up and show, well, there's this departure that the reason was given seemed to be not adequate. It's all public. And so it's just notable to me that we don't have that. This is a pretty complicated area of law, and there's a lot of things combined here in the bill. I guess the thing that one thing that jumped out at me, I'm looking on page 3, I guess it is, the middle of the page, that requiring a court to look back at the prior convictions to see whether the offender or an accomplice had in possession used a firearm. This could go back many decades, right? I mean, depending on how old somebody is, I don't know, this might be 40, 50 years. How would that work? I'm just not aware of that in any other laws. We'd be requiring a court to do that kind of analysis.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I fail to see the complication. It's pretty simple. Did they have a prior felony violent conviction proven beyond a reasonable doubt where a firearm was involved? If so, and this is their third time doing specifically that, I don't care how many years it's been, they've probably opted out of polite society. And to your broader point regarding departures, I think it's entirely appropriate for the people of Minnesota to express through statute that past a certain point, we are putting our foot down. We don't care what your reasons are. We don't care what your story is. We don't care what excuses you have for why three times you have been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, proven to have engaged in a crime with a firearm. Past that point, I don't want to hear the detailed explanation in a departure statement from a judge as to why we shouldn't throw the book at them.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Representative Hudson, I guess the concern is, yeah, you're putting your foot down on something that may not even exist. I mean, this is why we actually want to look at specific incidents and specific cases and understand them. You're saying, you know, somebody who has three violent convictions should be sent to prison, and in fact, the law requires that they go to prison. What you're requiring is that they go to prison for a greater length of time. Interestingly, the way this is written, it would be just one extra day, correct? I mean, a judge could comply with this just by giving somebody one extra day in their sentence, is how I read this. Is that correct?
Representative Hudson. I had a hard time understanding or hearing the question. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, I'm not sure I understand the premise of your question. The maximum, as I recall, the statute says, or the bill says, you're going to impose the maximum statutory penalty. I don't know how that would translate to one extra day, and I suppose it would depend very much on whatever other type of sentence that's a downward departure they were considering.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, no, Representative Hudson, like if you look at that, it's, the area I was pointing to before, which I guess is page, and I'm sorry, it was page two, actually, not page three. Stable has confused me. So, line 2.14. So, the judge, for this particular section, must impose an aggravated durational departure, which just means that if the number of months is whatever number of months is the top of the box, the judge has to exceed that up to the statutory maximum. So, the maximum the judge could do it is up to the statutory maximum. As long as the judge imposes an aggravated durational departure, so one day, a week, a month, anything, they can't exceed the statutory maximum. But the way this is written is that the judge has to impose it, does have to impose aggravated durational departure. That assumes the judge, that we get through separation of powers problems. But if we do, then the judge can do it just by doing an extra day or week. I guess maybe it's your intent that the judge actually would have to do it up to the statutory, that they would have to actually reach the statutory max. They can't sort of stop midway. Is that right? What are you intending?
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I believe you're making the argument for me here that there's still discretion that the judge has to decide how long the person is going to be sentenced. What we're saying is we're sick and tired of the downward departures for people who have three violent criminal felony convictions involving firearms proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Past that point, I'm happy to let a judge have some flexibility in how they're going to sentence, but it ain't going to go down. It can go up.
Representative Pinto, I'd like to point out in line 3.31, or 3.30 to 3.31, person convicted and sentenced as required by this section is not eligible for probation, parole, discharge, or work release until that person has served a full term.
Yes, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so pursuant to that sentence, it means that if the judge did give that extra day, the person would have to serve all the way to that extra day. It wouldn't mean that it served the statutory maximum. Those are sort of different points. And Representative Hudson, I think, again, we want to be really careful with identifying what problem we're trying to solve and what solution are we bringing forward. Because the problem of you having concerns about downward durational departures, which we don't have one example of actually, but perhaps at some point we will, that's not the problem being solved here. The problem being solved here is that you think that people not receiving downward departures is bad. You want them to get upward departures. So these are different things. And we sort of had skipped past this, but I did want to just get back to the point earlier about having to look back at prior convictions. It is not a small matter to try to figure out from a conviction from 20 years earlier if an accomplice, somebody else, not the offender themselves, was in possession of a gun. That's probably going to require a lot of digging. So I just, there's a lot of concerns with how this is structured, but I guess fundamentally, I'm just still trying to figure out, I know the general rhetorical problem you're trying to solve, or sort of the message it's trying to send, perhaps. But the question is, what actual problem are we trying to solve? A reminder that anybody convicted, anybody for whom this applies, is already receiving a significantly longer guideline sentence because, in fact, they've got a violent felony involving a gun. I understand your concern that then there are these downward departures, which you don't like. Boy, let's have some examples of that because it's all available and it's all public. And just sort of having a sense of how things are working is not probably not a great way to legislate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. And while I appreciate the legalese and the academia of the lawyer of the lawyers in the room, we're simply trying to get to a point in which Minnesota recognizes that committing three violent felony conviction actions with a firearm is held to a standard that cannot go down. And that seems to be a reoccurring theme that we don't want to address. There are instances of that occurring. A 2014 study showed that we have downward departures for mandatory minimums in 56% of all gun cases in Hennepin County and 53% statewide. We don't want that to happen anymore. And I think that this language strikes at exactly that. So thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representatives Engen and Pinto. So I want to address this notion of having a general sense as opposed to coming in here with some sort of dissertation with a bunch of citations, citing every time there's been a downward departure involving somebody who's had three different violent felony convictions. The fact of the matter is the general sense that I have is based in observable principle. If in fact this isn't happening, then there's no argument against it. We know it's happening. I don't know how, I mean, the idea that, yeah, we have access to this public information, so yeah, I didn't bring in a Rolodex of file cards with downward departure notes on it, but the minute we leave here, that research can and will be done, and then you're gonna have to answer to why you were claiming this isn't a problem. And I'll take that bet any day of the week. We have a problem with activist judges giving reduced sentences based on irrelevant criteria like their personal story and what they look like and their skin color and where they grew up, and not take into account the conduct, which we discussed during a previous bill, and how harmful that is and the ongoing public safety threat that it poses to people in Minnesota.
Co-Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to be clear, because you've thrown the statistic around about three quarters. Can you tell us precisely what you were looking at when you said three quarters of, I just missed it, like the violent felony? What statistic are you looking at there?
Representative Pudgeon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Mueller. Where I got that from in my statement is from research that I don't have in front of me at the moment, but I believe it's on my desk. Or at my seat. So the point is, I can give the answer later.
You might be phoning a friend right here unintentionally.
We have a report from the Sentencing Guideline Commission. It was with the graph referring to 2nd District, Ramsey County, and 4th District, Hennepin County. I don't see it in 2024. A specific judge, who I shall not name, had the lowest mitigated departure rate of 31%. The lowest mitigated departure rate was 31%.
All right, and I guess I don't know enough about what cases we're talking about. Are you just talking about all violent felonies? And the reason I ask, I guess, more importantly, is I took a look because I know in past years we've I've often heard citations to the guidelines about the cases allegedly involving firearms and then those where the mandatory minimums were given. And so the sentencing guidelines list county by county what the percentage is. And the cases where the most mandatory minimums were ignored, when there were, I looked at
counties with greater than 12 cases allegedly involving a firearm were Mille Lacs at 0%, Pine County at 1%, Nobles at 6%, Benton and Crow Wing at 8%. When I looked at the cases allegedly involving firearms in the metro, Anoka was at 36%, Dakota 29%, Hennepin 30%, Ramsey 42%, and Washington 28%. And so, you know, there's always this idea that, like, the metro is doing something nefarious with these cases. And when you dig into the details, you'll see that in greater Minnesota, the mandatory minimum is given less frequently than in some of these counties than it is in the metro area. I also just wanted to comment in the sake of time, because I know there's a couple amendments, too. Victims were invoked, and I don't know that any victim advocacy groups were consulted here. Certainly don't know that any victim advocacy groups that work with gun violence victims or survivors were consulted with this. I'll note that sometimes departures are given because victims in cases just don't want to cooperate, and cooperate maybe is not the right word, or don't want to testify. And so for them, having agreeing to a plea deal where there's a lesser sentence might be something that they actually desire. And so I just wanted to make sure that to mention that as well. And then to Representative Pinto's point about whether or not it's hard to prove whether an accomplice at the time of an offense years and years, decades ago, had in possession a firearm is very difficult. Even now, if there's a firearm in a car with four people, it's very hard to even prove who is the person in possession of that firearm, let alone decades ago. And of course, to satisfy Blakely, I'm sorry you look so bored with this, but in order to satisfy Blakely, the Supreme Court case, a prosecutor has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt those factors. So it is very difficult to prove and does require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. With that, I'll stop.
A little out of order, but it sounds like Representative Pinto, did you have a final comment? No?
No.
Okay, misinterpreted. Well, Representative Hudson, respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Mohler. You misinterpret. I'm not by no means bored. I'm frustrated and befuddled because this seems like a pretty simple concept, and I don't understand why it continues to be complicated by questions of process. If there's any ambiguity as to whether or not a firearm was involved in a violent felony conviction, then that's probably not going to count towards this total. And that's fine. If anything, you're making the case stronger for this, because in a case where it's unambiguous that a firearm was involved in a violent felony conviction, and it's happened three times, there is no reason that person should have access to early release, to parole, to reduce sentencing. They certainly, at the very limit, if there's going to be any departures, it should go up. And if it is, in fact, just one day, well, that's one more day the people of Minnesota will be safe.
Thank you. This is a long-standing case. I've had a bill that I originally carried. The concept of, you know, third strike, and this is in statute. It's not something that we invented. It's been there a long time. At some point, someone probably sat in this room and passed this bill that they thought it would be a good idea, that someone on that third time at the plate and getting the chance needs to serve their time. Originally, the bill had the language of shall instead of may. That's what we wanted to change, shall to may, which means that some point, members just like us sat in this room and wanted to hold people accountable and make sure that after the third time they've demonstrated their willingness to use violence, that they not be given less of a sentence to protect the victims out there. There is an amendment, and I have reviewed the amendment, DE2, and I find that that amendment is out of order. And
Mr. Chair,
House File 33. 380 is laid over.
Mr. Chair.
No.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
We have not traditionally called amendments out of order in this committee. That is something that I've seen on the floor, but I have, in all my years in the legislature, have not once seen that in committee.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, we'll be laying this over, and if you want to pull it up again, you can do that.
Mr. Chair, can you give the ground? Can you give the grounds, Mr. Chair, for ruling it out of order? What was your grounds?
This meeting is adjourned.
Now, what is... Wow.